Welcome to WeAreTechnology.com's User Friendly 2.0 with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. Welcome to the sweet show. Bill Gretchen, welcome.
Hello. Hello.
So as we started talking about last week, we are entering the season of giving. And this year, we're proud to support the William Temple House. In our second segment, their executive director is going to come on and tell us about their program and what they're trying to do and the services that they give out. And this is an amazing charity. They've been around for a very long time. He'll get into that. But their services, which deal with mental health and operate a food bank, are even more important this year than ever. So stay tuned for segment two. We're going to jump to that and give you an idea of exactly what the season of giving is going to be about. All right, guys, what do we have in the news this week?
All right, the Mandalorian and Grogu trailer just broke a 47-year-old Star Wars rule.
All right, so I'm going to talk about what's going on here, and then Gretchen, I'm going to want to get your opinion on this, since you are our resident Star Wars expert. So the trailer just came out, as it said. It features Grogu, who is the alien Yoda type, and then Din Djarin, who is the Mandalorian. So what we're looking at here is a case where you have someone in a mask, a helmet, and an alien. So what is being whined about here is that this is unusual for Star Wars not to have human characters and feature alien characters, although I'm not sure a Mandalorian qualifies as alien in my opinion, but that is where they're going. They're going to say this is really a change from all of the other Star Wars movies, and they're going to be placing the more human characters in the background. So, Gretchen, what do you think?
See, I kind of disagree with this because it's a buddy film. Just like the Han Solo, the Solo film, that was a buddy film. You have Han Solo and Chewbacca.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's kind of like, and then you have the Ahsoka series. She's the main character. So, and she's not a human or human-like character. And so I kind of disagree with this. I don't really, I just don't agree.
I think, you know, if I had to make a comment on this, I would say that I don't think this is particularly relevant to whether the movie is going to be good or not. I don't know, but what do you think about all this? Is it necessary to have humans in the first part of a science fiction film just because others have done it in the franchise?
No. It's a sci-fi film.
It's the same thing with Farscape. Look at all of the aliens. There's just one, you know, or two characters that are like humans.
Right.
And it's like, we don't need to have everything look, it's what's inside the character that you relate to, not the outside of the character. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so it's kind of like, I agree completely. I think, you know, and by the way, the feedback on this is basically the same thing. It's about your answer. It's just, no, why are we talking about this? This is ridiculous, right? Uh-huh. And even if you're looking at the franchise, I don't know about the characters, but certainly episode 8 and 9 felt like they were written by aliens, illiterate ones. But the thing of it is, you know, you have that interaction too.
Yeah.
I can hear the keyboards typing. What's next on news?
Is legacy code in technology systems reaching a breaking point?
So this has actually been an amalgamation of listener questions that have been coming in that we didn't get to the Q&A last week. And I did a little research on it and wanted to put it in the news because it is actually something that is important. And what this is talking about is computers are now, you know, they've been around. Microcomputers have been around since the 70s, mainframes and stuff before that. And today, as we sit here, code that goes back to that era is still being used in some systems, specifically things like banking and travel and all of that, COBOL, Fortran, and it works. And part of the reason why they continue to use it, it works. So the question that's happening here is, as you have this type of old code in software and hardware, is it causing a problem? Is it sitting out there and doing different things? So I'm going to go ahead and describe this in this way. Let's look at technology. We talk about sci-fi here on the show a lot, but let's look at this from a hardware perspective. Let's say that you have in the 1970s technology that was created to make cyborgs. Okay. And then in the 1990s, you have someone that modded at that point, and the superior life form had all of the upgrades that would be current at that time. Now, fast forward to 2025, and like any other complex system, there's maintenance and things that are done, and you're swapping out parts and upgrading things, but you still might have some of the original technology embedded into the system. Same thing applies to software. So what ends up happening in some cases is if you don't have someone that knows the entire system, or some of the original source code has been, you know, not buried, conceivably you would have it, but not known about by the current programmers, it becomes easier to trigger something that you don't know is there that can cause problems. So that's what raises the question here. Is it time to throw it all away and do something new? Is that required for security and that type of a thing? General research on this says no, but as you're working on and working with legacy systems been around for a while, it is important that the engineers on it understand where it came from. Maybe not how to program it from scratch, but you should know what's in your source code and stuff, you know? If you look, what was the character? I think he's a Marvel character that was a cyborg and had things programmed into him that if you triggered certain things, Winter Soldier.
Okay.
So let's say your cyborg has something like that based in their original source code, and you don't know about it anymore, then somebody comes out and triggers it, like, you know, I don't know, maybe the base frequency of a subwoofer or something. And that causes the cyborg to react in a way that wouldn't be terribly nice, right? You can have this, again, science fiction comparative, but you can have the same thing in real world systems. So, in other words, you need to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And in this day and age, things do change quickly, and sometimes it is very difficult to cover just new code going out from point A to point B, much less understanding the base of what's going on. But if you can't do that, then yeah, it is time that you would look at changing things out. However, the time consumption of something like that might make it worthwhile to know what the code base is that you're writing on.
So is there a way to... Let's say something's written in an older language like a COBOL or a Fortran. Is there a way to take that language and give it a little bit of a modern injection? Or is it just old and it's not going to be able to be upgraded?
Okay, so generally speaking, in these type of environments, and I'm going to speak from when I've had to deal with some code like this that we've used for clients, basically, what you have going on there is it's an old language. If you have someone that knows it, you can inject modern elements. It's not like it can't be changed today. But what ends up happening is modern programmers don't know the old language, so they end up relying on resources that are there that they can get to. But it, as far as what kind of is behind the curtain, they may or may not know. So what's generally done is the old code is encapsulated, and you access certain elements of it in your modern system and put the two together. Like that. I don't consider that to be a good way to work because you have this exact problem. There might be other parts of it that are dormant that could accidentally be, and not even nefarious. You send in a command to do something and it does something weird because you didn't know that's what it was set up to do in the first place.
So, okay, I'm going to ask another stupid question. Why can't you train an AI to understand these older languages?
Oh, wouldn't boy, they the be computer able to help? Keyboards are clicking again on the comments with that question.
Okay. Well, if you don't have humans who can understand it, then could you develop AIs that understand it?
Actually, that's already been done. And generally speaking, from that standpoint, what you do is, let's say you have ChatGPT analyze the code. You could certainly do that. And then what you want to do to be sure is say, have you know, say Gemini analyze ChatGPT's response, you know, and give its response. So you get opinions from different AIs, and that will allow you to look at these different things. You take that feedback, and then if you're getting a commonality where there's 10,000 lines of code here that, you know, aren't being accessed or aren't being used anymore, then maybe it's a good idea to look at that part of the system and either understand what it does if you need it and remove it if you don't.
Okay.
So
interesting.
So in layman's terms, what's going on is you have a foundation that is old code and a new building that's built on top of it, but nobody knows exactly what's in the foundation anymore.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
That's a very, very good analysis. So anyway, you know, as our systems get more complicated, we're going to need to deal with these things, but yeah, that's, so what's the answer to that? Is it at a breaking point? No, but it does require that, you know, you have someone that can at least understand the foundation.
All right. Maybe pull some people out of retirement. Jeff Bezos will be co-CEO of a of an AI startup project called Prometheus.
Yeah, you right? know, we all have things where it's time to change jobs. And, you know, I guess Jeff's tired of, you know, his current setup selling a lot of things, like, you know, everywhere. So it's time to do something new. Actually, I shouldn't poke fun at that. I'm doing the exact same thing. I just am not Jeff Bezos and I don't have his bank account. I wish I did. But that being said, yeah, he's moving over to this new project, as you say, and they're putting together something that could be very interesting in building AI that's going to be in a number of different things, including embedded systems and some other things like that. So, you know, some of these things could be spacecraft, exoskeletons, and so on. It goes from there. And this also gives you a little bit of a difference in the idea of, you know, bank accounts and where you're coming from. They're saying that they think they're reasonably funded, maybe at $6.2 billion in venture capital. You know, I'm sorry, they're having to start up on that shoestring, you know?
Gosh. Unremovable spyware on Samsung devices comes pre-installed on Galaxy Series devices.
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting, isn't it? And the other thing that's kind of really even more interesting about it, and it's like Samsung don't do this, is this only seems to be the case on their budget models, the Galaxy A and M series. So if you get your, you know, one of the, like the Folds or, you know, some of the newer ones, the Galaxies and all that kind of thing, you're not going to have this problem. And what happens with this is a lot of these applications are built into the operating system. So these phones run on Android, and while these would not be a part of a stock version of Android, you don't get a stock version of Android. You get the one that comes with the device that is highly customized by both the device manufacturer and usually the cellular companies that are on Verizon. They have their customizations that they require on it. And that's also why when updates come out, they go at different levels, because it's not just one update. The update has to go to the vendor, and then it has to go to the seller, and then eventually it gets to you. So what's happening here is these apps, the spyware and marketing and these different kind of things are being shipped with these phones, and you can't really uninstall it without jailbreaking the phone or something like that, which most people don't know how to do. And if you do do it, it can screw up your warranties and things like that. So the only option you really have is to, number one, know it's there. That's the first clue, you know, that you're going to know what to remove. And then there is a way to go in and disable it. Basically, you're turning it off. You cannot remove it, but you can disable it from functioning and then hope that it actually really is disabled. So the only time that I've ever worked with one of these budget models is my mom had a series a while back, and that got replaced because it was either that or meeting therapy. Every time I needed to show her how to add a contact or something, it was slow, and it was clearly monetized, in my opinion, or making up for the fact that the phone itself was cheap to begin with. And things that are basic functions in most phones, it didn't have, as a, for example, a QR code reader. And the only way to get one is you had to install an app, and that app comes with in-app purchases and, you know, other things. Your higher-end phones, that's built into your camera function, you know. So it's definitely a situation where this is being targeted, in my opinion, at least from what it looks like, and it is a thing. So one of the old things that I've been always told is free can be very expensive. So it's not really free. You're paying for it in some way. So the price is less. You know, some of these phones are $80, $90 for a full smartphone. But of course, you're selling personal privacy, your analytics, and other things that you can't necessarily disable or turn off to get the lower price on the phone. Because even with how cheap it is to manufacture electronics these days, a full functioning smartphone that's done right would still cost more than $80 to make, you know, so you got to look at it from that perspective, that it's not really cheap. It's just monetarily less than the other ones, and you have a trade-off for that.
Wow.
Reminds me of the Kindles.
Of the what? Oh, the Kindles. Yeah. Yeah. Where you can, and if what you're talking about is you buy it, it's cheaper, but you get ads. And if you pay more for the same device, then you don't get ads.
Yeah. Okay, Cloudflare down. X and more apps hit by internet outage.
I'm sorry, haven't we already done this story like twice in the last month?
I know.
Yep.
It's
Yep, we have.
This time it was Cloudflare. Yeah. So what is Cloudflare? Because that is definitely a question that
haven't we
is
talked
going
about
to be,
Cloudflare before?
We've talked yes. about it, yes. And but again, it's one of those things that's kind of hidden in the background. So what Cloudflare is it's a cloud management service, an edge cloud service, and it also handles authentication to try and stop things like denial of service attacks and stuff like that. So when you go to a website that uses Cloudflare, it's going to deliver, you know, based on closest servers and that type of stuff automatically. And it's also going to try to check your browser to make sure that you're not like a bot trying to harvest information from a website or something like that. So as far as the service goes, it's actually quite valuable, in my opinion. We use it for a lot of our clients, including our own sites. But like anything else, technology is subject to having problems. And Cloudflare had one of these problems this last week that took down, as you say, X and other things. ChatGPT was out for a little while. I think even WhatsApp was affected maybe, but there were some other things like that that were just, you couldn't access them. And same kind of feeling of something going down, like the AWS and the Azure problems over the last couple of weeks for a different reason. They've issued an apology and did get things back up and running pretty quickly. And this is another example, like the other ones, of where something has been fixed, but it takes a while to get things back online. But yeah, that's what happened.
Do newly released images of 3i Atlas confirm Harvard astrophysicist suspicions?
I think they might. Okay, so what we're talking about here is something that has been looking at the idea that this is a alien spacecraft and looking at different things from it to try and substantiate that. So, you know, everything, what would be an opinion on that? Let's set that aside for a minute and just talk about what's going on here. He's looking at the fact that it is in a lot of ways not acting like a normal comet. It seems to be able to correct course. It seems to be able to have thrust. The normal tail of the comet sometimes goes in the opposite direction. The exhaust from it contains elements that we have never seen naturally created in space before, like arsenic. So there's a lot of things going on here that would tend to substantiate a position like that if you look at it from that standpoint. Now, needless to say, the scientific community is, let's just say, not been terribly accepting of this theory.
No, I've seen counter stories, so yes, I was just curious to see what just, you thought. You
know,
yeah,
because of course, you know, aliens are impossible. We're the center of the universe, yada yada, right? So the thing of it is at the end of the day, he's just saying that he's looking at an alternate approach, and these are all the reasons why, and it's changed colors and other things like that. So there are some things about this spacecraft, I mean comet, that would tend to say that it's a little bit different from anything else that we've seen. There's a lot of good pictures up now with the government reopening. NASA's releasing their stuff. ESA, European Space Agency, has put some stuff out, and it's going to get closer. I believe December 19th is the closest flyby when the aliens will actually come visit us. So, you know, we'll have to
see, set I up thought maybe it was a probe, you yeah, know, well, like exploration, you know, like a Voyager. You know?
From my understanding, the stories of the Alpha Centauris is they've already been here with their probe. So, you know, I guess they've gotten all the information they can that way. All right. We'll
you know what I'm
along here.
Oh, man, this took a really weird turn.
So let's go to something completely different and talk about some of the kitchen gadgets, jeez, for 2025 holiday season, please. So we're going to be doing our annual holiday show next week and talking about some of the more general stuff that's out there. But we get asked questions a lot about kitchen gadgets. And this is something that more and more of this, like anywhere else in the house, you're seeing specific things. But to give kind of an idea of a wrap up of what is on the list for those that are chefs, and I had to look all this up because I am not. My idea of, you know, cooking something is boiling water and putting it, you know, Chef Mike. But there are others that can seem to do a little better job. And to do that, a lot of these devices are kind of cool. One of them is the Avona Precision Cooker 3.0. Okay, so this is described as a smart Sois Vide, that's how it's spelled, circular and upgraded Wi-Fi connectivity and better controls. Okay. So my question is, well, okay, that's all very nice, but what is it? Right. And this is a device that is a immersion circulator. Okay. And that's where the Sois Vide on comes from. Designed for home.
Immersion circulator?
Immersion circulator. So you attach it to a pot of water. It heats and slip away the water to a precise temperature, and then you can immerse vacuum-sealed food so you get consistent restaurant-level results, at least according to the manufacturer.
Yes, it's sous vide.
Sous vide? Okay. Yeah. I am not a chef, and I apologize.
I was wondering about that.
But it's interesting because all this stuff is Wi-Fi connected, you know, smart devices. And looking at some of the other things, there's one that is about $90 and it's a meat thermometer, but it is wireless and it has some kind of AI in it. So it can sense what you're doing with your holiday meal, whether you're roasting or whatever the case may be, something that they say is very giftful. And I guess you get advised when you need to, when your item is cooking or has finished cooking or reached certain thresholds. I'm still dealing with the fact that my refrigerator texts me when the water filter needs to be changed. So, you know,
I find that annoying. I think I'm just happy with my Braville. It does the air fryer thing. It reheats food. Yeah. It's a toaster. It's a really awesome thing. I'm really happy with it.
The next three items on the list are air fryers. So you're hitting it right on the head there. I have to say, I have a Ninja air fryer that's a few years old now, and I do use it. It's just easier to deal with. And, you know, I actually can handle that a little better than something as alien as an oven. So, you know, it kind of kind of goes from there. But these are popular items. And like I say, the next three, the Breville, if I'm saying that right, has a smart oven air fryer.
At least that's how I said
it. Probably you're right. And high tech meets everyday cooking. Again, a smart device, being able to monitor things. And another one that's a little more budget friendly is, okay, I'm really not going to doing well with the name today. Gourmania, French door air fryer, Gourmia, G-O-U-R-M-I-A. I apologize. I know I'm saying that right. But again, it's another air fryer that costs a little bit less and has a lot of these features. And then the third one is another one by the same company that is a little bit more expensive. It features a window where you can see the cooking progress. My Ninja has that too. I'm not sure that's a new feature, but it says they say that they blend utility and cool design. So these are some of those items that you probably would actually need to go to, you know, be real old fashioned and go to a brick and mortar store to check out and see what the differences are. You can only get so much from the pictures online, but air fryers are a big deal this year. And I can, like I say, all joking aside, and the fact that I can't cook, I do understand that. What was that, Gretchen?
I know the Braville works because we had a previous one that was just a toaster oven. And when we got the Braville toaster oven, an air fryer, we knew it was going to work well.
Yeah.
And it has. You know, it's, and brand quality, it was worth it. It's expensive. Like that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it does cost a little more, but in these cases, you do go what you pay for, I think. You know. Mm-hmm. So, and if you actually want to go to the other side of that, find a few stocking stuffers, that type of thing. Williams-Sonoma has a holiday spatula set. It's holiday themed, you know, spatulas is whatever it does with that. I don't know how much to say for it. This isn't QVC where I can talk for an hour on something like that, but it would be kind of cool for somebody that's cooking. And the other one that kind of falls along these lines is a product made by Ice Diver. It's a 33 ball ice mold set, and you can make custom ice cubes or ice balls made out of different ingredients for drinks and whatnot. And unlike the ghosts that we tried to use for Halloween,
this one works. I was able to make them work. Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, it's me in the kitchen. So, you know, there we are. Heaven help us. All right. Our next segment, we are going to be talking about our season of giving. This is User Friendly 2.0. We'll be back after the break. This is User Friendly 2.0. Welcome back. As we enter this year's season of giving, we want to talk about an amazing charity that User Friendly is proud to be able to support. William Temple House in Portland is working to make sure every neighbor feels the warmth of the season. From their food pantry and warm clothing program to counseling and essential support services, they help families facing hardship find hope and stability. This holiday, they're bringing comfort, dignity, and a little extra cheer to those who need it most and have been doing this for many, many years. For details on them, check out userfriendly.show. We're going to have a link at the top of our page. And right now, I'd like to welcome their executive director, who's going to tell us and deep dive into their program for this year. Joining us now, Graham, executive director of William Temple House. Welcome to User Friendly.
Hey, Bill, thank you. Gretchen, thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah,
thank you for joining us for this year's Season of Giving. Your organization is absolutely incredible. And before we started recording, we were talking that, you know, I've worked with some of your people for a long time now, but it's the first year that we're going to be able to have the pleasure of directly supporting such a just needed cause right now. And what I'm going to do is just kind of throw this over to you. If you can give us some of your background, what you're doing, just the general 411.
Sure. Sure. So we were formed 60 years ago this year to provide free mental health counseling originally to this neighborhood where we're located in Northwest Portland. Since that time, we've stuck to our mission of free and low-cost mental health counseling, although now we serve Portland and the greater Portland, Vancouver, Washington area. Along the way, we added a food pantry because we realized we heard from our mental health clients that that was another big obstacle, and them really being well for a lot of them was also putting food on the table. So now for the past at least 20 years, we do free and low cost mental health counseling and a free shopping style food pantry.
So how does that work? Do people that are in need just kind of show up? Do they make appointments? Tell us a little bit about how, you know, what somebody would see.
Sure. The most visible part is the food pantry. It's open 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. No appointment is needed. We open our gates and we keep working until either, you know, we run out of food or there's no line. And when I started, in this role about 2.5 years ago, when I started, 75 people coming to the pantry in a day was close to a record. You know, fast forward to 2025, first Tuesday of November last week, we served 167 people.
Wow.
And that's closer to normal. 145 now is not a record. It's just a normal day at the food pantry.
Wow.
The mental health support and counseling is a little bit different. People request our services often online or by telephone. And then those are by appointment, and folks usually see a therapist about 50 minutes for a 50-minute session, either once a week or once every 2 weeks. So that part's a very busy part of what we do too, but it's not the first thing you'd see walking up. It's a very one-on-one thing.
Right. Well, yeah, especially if you're going, I could see where the food would be more front-facing, and especially this year, because food insecurity is a problem, but this year it's really been a problem. And I can imagine that that's somewhat taxing to any food bank, including yours, the changes that we've been dealing with.
Yeah. You know, so as I said, we've been seeing a steady uptick in demand for 2 years or a little more. Then we started to see a decline in supply about a year ago. And it only got worse with the change in administration. So the decline in supply was a thing. It was happening before the administration, the new administration. Then the new administration made some pretty important cuts to the USDA's budget, and that resulted in less food coming from farmers to regional food banks where we get a lot of our supply. So over the past year, we've seen demand go up and supply go down. And that was the situation before the government shut down and before cuts to SNAP. So, of course, there have also been rolling cuts to SNAP and efforts to make SNAP harder to get and to get people off the rolls for SNAP, which obviously also increases the line at our food pantry. But all that kind of came to a head in the last week of October. We came together as a team and talked about what are we going to do in November. If people don't get their SNAP payments, everything I have just described is only going to get worse. And there was a lot of trepidation on the team. Like, could we do anything else in the context of steadily increasing demand and decreasing supply? Is there something else we could do? And we decided that we had to try to do something. And so we made a pledge that we'd find more food, and for the month of November, no one would go home empty-handed. And that was a scary pledge to make because over the last year, people have been going home empty-handed. I think as I said a minute ago, you know, we tend to close the pantry either when the food runs out or the line runs out. And there have been some time, but frequent times this year where the food's run out and we've had to say, we're done for the day. You'll have to come back at a different time. So it was scary to say in November, we're not going to turn anyone away. So far, we've been able to do it. So far, the community has stepped up. We found more food. We've gone out and bought food because most of our food is donated, but we've gone out and bought food. And so far, this is November 13th. We haven't had to turn anybody.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, you're pretty much halfway through the month and holding to that pledge, which I could see would be extremely difficult with everything in such a state of flux, you know? So we'll talk about in a little bit how people find you on the web to seek help and that type of a thing. But what I'd like to do is dive into the funding aspect of a little bit, because certainly a question that we are going to get from the audience is, how do we help? And we have a lot of amazing people out there that try, not just even this time of year, but to give back and support community programs like yours that really kind of make some people's lives worth living versus not. I mean, that really is what it comes down to. And there's a couple of ways I know that that you raise money. And what I'd like to do is get you to go into that, both, you know, monetary donations. And I understand you guys have a thrift store as well.
We do. Yeah, we do. Yeah. And so, you know, money's always the best thing because when we have money, for two reasons, you know, one is easy to understand. When we have money, when we have a budget, we can buy whatever the thing is that we're most missing in the moment. Right. So the other thing is that we can buy, we're in a coalition with 9 other food hunger focused organizations in Portland. It's called the CAFE Coalition, CAFE Advancing Food Equity. And we band together and purchase food wholesale. So if people give us money, we can buy more jars of peanut butter with the same money than if they went to the grocery store and bought a jar. That said, you know, I know people like to do that. I know people like the concrete. There are a lot of places, churches, schools, businesses, especially small businesses in this neighborhood that have a barrel, you know, in their lobby, and they take food donations for us as well. And that, we appreciate all of that as well. You know, whenever we can, we tend to say, like, give and get. Like, if you want to give us a jar of peanut butter and then give us $25 so we can buy 10 more jars, like, that would be perfect. We also do fund a part of our operation through our thrift store. So we own and run an award-winning thrift store on Northwest Gleason in Portland. And that generates around 10% of our budget, which maybe doesn't sound like much, but it's a great 10% that we can count on, that we raise ourselves, that you know, we don't have to go out and write a proposal for or run a campaign and hope we get. And we're growing the thrift store. We need, in these crazy uncertain times, you know, the more revenue that we can earn ourselves so that we don't have to depend on it from donors would be great. So we're also working to grow that thrift store business as well.
Okay, I'm going to just ask the question on this because I've heard this before, award-winning. Tell us what that means.
There's a couple of different, well, actually, there's a lot at this point, a lot of different, you know, top 10 lists and that kind of stuff. One of the most recent ones was we were in the Oregonian as one of Portland's 10 best nonprofit thrift stores. So there's a concrete answer. There's a bunch of top 10 lists that we keep appearing.
Yeah, I know that the reason I bring that up is because I've seen it, like you say, in a number of different places. And I throw that out there because a lot of times you'll see award winning and, you know, whatever that means, but you guys really are award winning. Yeah. I think it's important to point that out.
Yeah. Not just gold rimmeds in 1903. Like, you know, every beer has that. Right?
And there you are. You know, coming from Nevada, every buffet was award winning too. So, you know, you gotta go through all of that. So, all right. How does someone donate? Like, go ahead and tell us a little bit about the specific campaign you're doing this fall and how somebody would get to your website, donate monetarily. What is the exact process for that?
You know, the easiest thing, like, I know you're going to help us out by posting a link, but, you know, people can just, look up William Temple House online, and our campaign page is on our website. That's probably the easiest. And then it's, you know, it's just click and give.
Yeah. And there's a lot of options, I know, for one-time donation or ongoing. And then your organization, of course, is a 501c3. So there's all the relevant potential tax deductions and things that come along with that, too, I would assume.
There are. Yeah. And thank you for mentioning monthly giving. That's a great choice. If somebody's thinking about giving us $100, or if they would be willing to give us $10 a month, that would be even better.
Yeah. And you can do all this on an automatic setup. So it's not even like you have to think about it. And I think that is one of the best things to do, because, you know, we all get busy and you might forget, or you might not want to deal with the accounting. So you can just set it up and it's good to go. And at the end of the year, you know what you've donated. So I like it when it's easy.
Well, we try to make it easy. I mean, people are trying to help us and we don't want it to be hard for them.
Now, that totally makes sense. Outside of what we've talked about, are there any other specific needs that your organization has this fall?
Well, if anybody's listening and has a great source of free or wholesale eggs or meat or shelf-stable milk, that would be great. Those are things that we're finding sometimes, even when we're trying to buy them, we can't find enough available wholesale. That's probably not a surprise. I think we've probably all had the experience now of going to the grocery store and for some reason, one week there's no milk or there's no yogurt.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, it's since COVID, it's been like that. I mean, the excuse was COVID, but now it's like, it's just still the same thing. And then it seems like with inflation and stuff, when you do find eggs, you need an armored car to take them home.
Yeah. That's why I listed those things. Those are things that people come to the pantry really seeking. And are the hardest for us to keep in stock, you know, compared to
beans. There's a lot of gentlemen farmers around. I say gentlemen, they could be women, that have chickens in their backyard, and sometimes they have extras. So hopefully if we have any listeners who are these kind of people, maybe they will think of you and bring their spare eggs over to you.
It would be great. Yeah, those are the things that we struggle to keep on the shelf. And then I know people are really.
Well, yeah, I mean, basic staples. And that's really what all that comes down to, is that's what that is. So, all right, on the thrift store side, do you just take anything and everything, or are there specific donations you're looking for? And when can people donate?
You can donate whenever the store is open, which is every day, Monday through Sunday. It's closed. The only time it's closed is the third Monday of the month. That's a lot for people to remember, but it's on our website if people want to. But otherwise, we try to take donations as long as we're open. And I say try because occasionally we get flooded and we have to put up a sign and pause while we move things inside. But again, we try to be easy to help. So, you know, if we're open 11 to 7, our intention is to take donations whenever anyone comes. We take clothing, furniture, housewares. The most valuable things for us are often women's clothing and furniture. But again, so we love to get that stuff. We are trying to make it easy for people. And so we take a broader range and we resell a broader range of clothes and housewares and furniture.
I know that's great to kind of have that across the board. And I appreciate you saying that because, you know, we've all run into the, you know, I want to donate something and it's a great item. Oh, no, we don't take that. You know, so it's good to know that you're a place that you're not going to get disrespected when you bring something in.
No, we try hard. Yeah, and there are things we can't take. And we also spend a lot of time sorting. but we know that people, if they want to donate their stuff, they don't want to go to three different places to do it. So we try to make it as easy as we can.
No, absolutely. All right. So over the next 6 weeks here, give or take, hopefully we can hear back from you on how things are going. Yeah. And we're going to be talking about what's going on and updating every week. And to our own listeners, if you have any questions for William Temple House or anything that you'd like to find out, go ahead and also go to userfriendly.show, send them in there. And as we were just talking about the link to be able to donate, we'll be at the top of our website, as well as williamtemple.org, which is the website for your charity, the general website. If I correct me if I'm wrong on that.
That's true. That's right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. Now, that sounds absolutely amazing. Is there anything else you want to tell us?
You know, we spent a lot of time on food, and that's fair because Oregon has an official, you know, food emergency for November and December. We're seeing very similar things happen on the counseling side as well. We're seeing a record number of people coming to us looking for mental health support. We are seeing around 200 clients right now, and we have another roughly 100 on our waiting list. So, you know, our kind of tagline, you know, is William Temple House, food, counseling, and connection. And we're seeing just a huge demand for all of that right across the board. You know?
No, I can only imagine in this time too. And, you know, as far as that goes, now, can somebody seek counseling from you that doesn't have insurance? I mean, you know, because that's always a question that comes up.
Yes, and that is how a lot of people end up coming to us. We are free and sliding scale. Our sliding scale starts at $1. There are plenty of clients that don't pay anything. And there are clients that pay farther up that sliding scale. A lot of them are here. A lot of our clients are here because they don't have insurance. Surprisingly, around a third of our clients do have insurance. But you might have run into yourself, but sometimes just because you have insurance doesn't mean you can find a provider who will accept it.
Yeah.
Oh, no, never had that at any time. Sarcasm sign, right? Yeah.
I think that was a shock to me when I started this job, that we are not processing insurance, and yet around a third of our clients are insured. They just can't find a provider. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a little bit scary going down that road because it's both sides of the things. There's a lot more need for help. And there's a lot, you know, it taxes anybody that offers these things. But the thing of it is the donated dollars go far, you know, even with the inflation and everything that's going on. And if you know how much it is just to pay for a counseling, you know, session straight out, I know just a donation of $100 is one session that covers, you know, the whole thing end to end. So we're not talking about huge big bucks or some, you know, Fifth Avenue deal that, you know, to get in there and even walk in the lobby is $1,000. It actually, you get a lot when you donate, you get a lot of bang for that buck.
Absolutely. I appreciate you saying that as well. And then, you know, something else that I did not say was that we're also a training center. And so we currently have about 15 graduate student interns in the counseling department. A lot of our therapy is provided by those interns, overseen by a more senior, fully licensed therapist. And we're really trying to attack the mental health part of the challenge in Portland at both ends. And so we are treating people's immediate needs right now. And we're also helping educate the next generation of kind of community focused, community based mental health workers. Because, you know, Oregon ranks near the bottom of the list. We are, depending on which list, either dead last or 48th in the country for access to mental health services. And so we're working as fast as we can to provide mental health services, but also to help build out that pool of educated providers that Portland needs so badly.
Yeah, and you're talking about more of a long-term setup there, and it is so important because if you don't do that, well, great, you have someone today, but people retire and people move and different things happen, and all of a sudden you don't have the experts anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And we know we can't do it alone, but that is kind of the shorthand for us for our mission is we want to get Portland off the bottom of that list. we don't want to be 50. You know, Portlanders love Portland, you know, and we should be really upset that we're at the bottom of that list. And so we're trying to get up higher.
Oh, that's great. Well, check out williamtemple.org or go to our show website, userfriendly.show, for the links. All of the information will be there. Feel free to ask your questions. And in this season of giving, I know things are a little tighter this year, but your help really does go a long way. Graham, thank you for joining us today.
Gretchen, Bill, thank you both very much.
So there's always two sides to every coin, it seems. And while there are a lot of amazing, real, genuine charities out there like William Temple House, it is important to vet anybody that you would support, especially if it's somebody that you're not particularly familiar with. Now, William Temple House has a 60-year plus background in Portland and has been doing their job effectively for a long time. It's easy to know that they're real. But like anything else, this time of year, we get busy and the scammers know that. And they try to separate you from some of your money, making you think that it's going to a good cause. There are sites like Charity Finder, and you can also, in the United States, look up on the IRS's website if a charity is registered. Same thing exists in the UK and in Canada. So these are some ways to go about doing it. Now, I would be looking at a charity and the million other things I have to do this time of year and probably wouldn't go out and do that. So while that might be the smartest way to do it, let's talk reality. Go online and check the references just like you would for a product you're going to buy or a business that you're going to support. And from that, you're going to be able to get a lot of information. Is this group real? Is this group genuine? Look at, if you want to dig in a little bit more, how much of, if they are a registered charity, how much of the contribution goes to things like administrative costs and what goes towards the actual goal of it? Is the charity effective or are they 95%, you know, to pay somebody's salary or something like that?
Yeah.
These are all things that are important to look at. And if something feels like it has a red flag, listen to your gut. And in that case, if you still want to donate, then do take the time to do the further research. We're seeing a lot of things out there where it's looking very good. We talk about AI on the show all the time and something that all of us have our own opinion on. But with that, it's allowing the scammers to look a lot better than they used to. And it makes it a lot harder to be able to really know. You know, it used to be a year ago, if an email came in, it was a scam and you really looked at it, there would be things that were off and you could kind of tell. Not so much the case anymore. So if you're going to give money, if you're going to hire a company, if you're going to buy something and it's out of an email that just came in that solicited or a phone call or something like that, first of all, don't. And second of all, if you really do want to check it out, because there are a lot of good small businesses out there and things too. So it's not only go to the big guys, but go online, find the website that actually belongs to the company, service, charity, whatever it is that you're wanting to look at, support. And check into it using the information on their actual website. Don't use anything that came in the email, that type of a thing. It's the same rule of thumb that if you get a thing that, you know, your Chase Visa card has been charged $10 million, and if you don't want to call this number, there's probably something wrong with that email. But if you do want to check it out, don't call a number in that email. Go to your Chase credit card, look at the number on the back, and use that to contact them. Same rule of thumb holds for pretty much any of these things. And that being said, there's a lot of genuine charities out there that really can use support this year that are very good and very genuine and very worthwhile to get and help people that really are in need of help. Just don't let your dollars go to the wrong guy. Until next week, this is User-Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
Hey, everybody. This is Bill Snodgrass. Join User-Friendly in supporting the people of the Ukraine with President Zelensky's United 24 campaign. Help is needed with healthcare, demining, and many, many other things. You decide where your support goes. Go to userfriendly.show and click the Ukrainian flag at the bottom of the homepage for more information.
User-Friendly 2.0 Copyright 2013 to 2025 by User-Friendly Media Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. Content is the opinion of the show's participants and not necessarily this station or platform. Requests for material use, interviews, CCPA, privacy notice for California residents, GDPR information for UK and EU residents, and any other feedback may be submitted at userfriendly.show. We welcome your input. Thank you for listening.